Hello, and welcome to the audio edition of Beastly Business, the first in a series of animal behavior, human-animal bond mysteries, written and read by Myrna Milani. Chapter 3. After a brisk 3-mile jog home, I got into my old Saab, fully intending to drive to the Somerset police station. However, the route there took me right by Tony's veterinary clinic. In addition to providing me with a place to see clients, Tony was a good friend who had served as my primary link to the medical community ever since I'd left practice to pursue behavioral and bond work full-time more than a decade ago. If anyone would understand my dilemma, he would. Tony's office manager smiled and pointed toward the back of the building the instant I entered, the signal that he was holed up in his private office. Once in that cluttered cubicle, I watched his expression grow more and more troubled as I described my meeting with Monica Sonko and the evidence I planned to take to the police. "I know it's probably the right thing to do," he agreed gravely. "I'm just not sure it's the smartest." "How come?" I asked the obvious question, even though I dreaded to hear what I suspected he'd say. "I know the scientific community is finally beginning to take your work seriously, but a lot of folks around here still think it's a little, well, strange." Tony looked up at the ceiling like someone who desperately wanted to be somewhere else, anywhere else, up to his eyeballs in rabid bats even. "Remember that article in the Eagle about the fortune teller you helped become one with her cat?" He gently reminded the ceiling of something I most certainly had hoped to forget. "And everyone knows how hard you took it when Bob died. Aurora Dawn wasn't a fortune teller. She ran a meditation center and the cat was ruining her prayer rugs." I cringed when I recalled that particularly badly written article about an eccentric former client. "And what's that and Bob's death have to do with anything?" I added defensively, not wanting to recall all the strange thoughts that ran through my mind when I learned that Bob had collapsed while having sex with a 20-year-old former high school cheerleader while everyone else in town was debating the school budget in the town hall. Everyone else, including me. "It shouldn't have anything to do with it, but Somerset's a small town." Tony's words had a kind but ominous ring to them. "You go running to the police with goat droppings and flower petals, claiming they prove that dog didn't kill that woman, and..." He let the sentence trail off, surely so he didn't have to come right out and tell me they'd think I was a lot stranger than they already did. "Why don't you check out your samples here first, Sinclair?" As sure as God made little white tapeworms, Tony made that suggestion in a graceful attempt to buy me some time to rethink my plan. "Mind if I borrow one of your scopes?" I waved the bag of droppings limply in his direction. He looked at me across the disaster he called his desk and grinned. "Use whatever you want." Once I actually stood in the lab of Tony's state-of-the-art clinic, I surveyed all the equipment in hopes it would give me some ideas. My training prepared me to examine samples for evidence of disease, not murder and whatever else Monica and her little ruminant roomie might have been up to. "Begin with what you know," I reminded myself when all the equipment stared back at me as dumbly as I stared at it. A routine urine analysis and microscopic examination of a small piece of the skin revealed nothing out of the ordinary that I could detect. Next, I dissolved one of the manure pellets in a clearing solution, spun the result in liquid in the centrifuge, and examined the sediment. I hadn't a clue what I expected to find, but training and experience programmed me for plant fibers, bacteria, or parasite eggs. Consequently, when I saw several tiny, obviously man-made objects under low power in the microscope, I had no idea what to make of them. I felt even more confused when I examined them under higher magnification and discovered that each one consisted of multicolored layers of a hard, smooth material that looked like plastic. "What do you know about goats?" I asked Tony a short time later as I slumped into the only chair in his office free of stacks of journals or books. "During the breeding season, bucks stink because they pee into their mouths and lick the urine into their fur." He rattled off one of the few facts about goats that I remembered too, with the seriousness belied by the twinkle in his dark brown eyes. "Come on," I laughed. "We all know that. What else do you know?" He shook his head, smiling. "I've been running an exclusively small animal practice for over 20 years, so you probably know more about goats than I do." He grinned apologetically. "What's the problem?" "My goat has what look like tiny multicolored pieces of plastic in its droppings, and I'd like to know what they are." "You think it's a marker of some kind?" he asked, rummaging through a pile of papers on the floor beside him. "Could be, I guess." I automatically began spinning a clump of curls to help myself think better. "Why?" "Because," he extracted a newsletter from a heap and began leaping through it, "there's a new prof at the college with a background in dairy science and physiology. Did some pretty sophisticated work. Maybe he can help you." He handed me the slick Hanover College publication, folded open to an article and a public reception for new faculty members scheduled for the next day. "Second column," he oriented me. "Raymond Midgley." "Pretty impressive credentials," I remarked, scanning the description of Midgley's wide range of scientific accomplishments, seeking references that might pertain to specific goat knowledge. "Betty's one of the Wentworth fellows." Tony's speculation referred to an eclectic group of adjunct faculty. That'd be my guess with that mixed background and those dual appointments at Hanover and her sister school in England. As I recall, a couple of the new ones have it. I murmured something appropriate as curiosity drove me to read about the other new additions. Sure enough, among them I discovered another new faculty member with dual appointments at Hanover College and the University of Crowning Shield Abbey in England. However, what really caught my attention wasn't Chandler McCarthy's dual appointments any more than his impressive credentials in molecular biology or his claim as a biomedical consultant. What riveted my attention was a summary of his successful moonlighting as, quote, "a mystery writer whose meticulous attention to detail and in-depth knowledge of the criminal mind have made him a welcome guest within the law enforcement and intelligence communities here and abroad," unquote. "Why don't you give him a call and see if he can help you?" Tony's cheerful voice drowned out the thought that had suddenly surged into my mind. "What?" I struggled vainly to recall what we'd been talking about before the thought overtook me. "Not what, Sinclair. Who?" Tony looked at me indulgently as he handed me a pad of paper and a pen. "Raymond Midgley. Go call him about your goat and let me get back to work." I took the pad and pen and quickly jotted down the phone number and email address of the new Wentworth Fellow at Hanover College. But I had no intention of contacting Raymond Midgley. The sheet of paper I tore off the pad contained everything I needed to get in touch with the mysteriously credentialed Chandler McCarthy. You've been listening to an excerpt from Beastly Business, an animal behavior and human-animal bond mystery written by veterinary ethologist Myrna Milani. For more podcasts, commentaries, books on animal behavior and the human-animal bond, and links to behavioral and bond sites, check out my website at mm@mmilani.com. For more specific information, feel free to email me at mm@mmilani.com. All rights related to the book Beastly Business in any form are retained by Myrna Milani. The background music in The Steppes of Central Asia by Alexander Bordin is used with permission of Katova Arts, www.katova.com.